graduated from Harvard Medical School. Dr. Green, for many years before he became Senator Green, turned to journalism. So that he has been managing editor of a number of publications in Boston and the New York Tribune, I believe it is. That's a newspaper right there. Senator Green also was the editor of The Nation for a number of years in the early 1920s. And then that's The Nation magazine that some of you are familiar with and reading. Also, Senator Green has been in Mexico writing about the Mexican Revolution down there in the 1920s. In 1924, he was National Director of Publicity for Senator Robert La Follette, running for president. In 1927, he wrote a book on Mexico and its heritage. When Franklin Roosevelt became president, he appointed Senator Green as Director of Territories, I believe. I'm not sure I have the right date for that appointment, but he was appointed to advise Secretary Cordell Hull and the United States delegation to the Inter-American Conference at Montevideo, the 7th Inter-American Conference. Then, after that, he was appointed first director of the Division of Territories and Island Possessions. This, of course, included the territory of Alaska, as well as that of Hawaii and several others that you're familiar with. However, the interesting feature about his appointment was that he set to work right away to abolish the agency of which he was the head, because he wanted these territories to become states and he wanted the other possessions to become as autonomous as possible. Now, Dr. Greening became then governor of Alaska. 1949, I believe, until 1953, he was governor of this state. Of this territory. And then later came back to represent the state at the Constitutional Convention when the Constitution of Alaska was being drawn up. He had a great deal to do with the preparation of that document. He did a great deal of speaking and lecturing and campaigning throughout the state previous to that time, telling people why this should be a state instead of a mere territory. Now, his achievements after he became governor were, of course, numerous. One of those that struck my attention was the abolition of discrimination for the natives in public places. The law passed providing for equal treatment of all races and nationalities in Alaska. As I said before, I want you to have as much time as possible with him, so I'm just going to cut short his long record of public service and introduce him to you right now as the speaker for this morning. He's going to leave you about 20 minutes to ask questions after he's through.
Professor Skin. I'm always impressed by the fact, based on my own experience, how relatively little we know about periods that preceded our participation in them. Now, statehood came to Alaska 9 years ago, but most of you were pretty young. And so really, probably you don't know too much about that long gone out battle. And yet, of course, it is the most important event in the history of our state. And this is merely of historical interest, because the reasons for statehood and the battles we fought then have a contemporary bearing. Many of the things that we were denied as a territory, we are still denied. And in a sense, you are not only listening to history and critical time, but you are participating in it. It's a gratifying fact that the Constitution Convention lowered the voting age that prevailed in most of the states, where all but two states at the time we came in had a voting age of 21, and lowered the voting age to 19, an action which I highly approve of. For the obvious reason that it seems to me if we can draft our young people to go and fight and die in wars, they certainly should have the privilege of voting and taking part in decisions which may lead to or prevent are engaging in war. And we're going through the period of reconstruction now after the 92 years of stepchildhood. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the fact that during those first 92 years, Alaska suffered neglect and discrimination from the federal government, really without any precedent or parallel in history. And that was why we really had to have status. And it was quite a battle. The original germ for ultimate status was found in the words of the Treaty of Session with Russia, which said, in these words, the inhabitants of the ceded territory that was ceded by Russia shall be admitted to all the advantages, rights, and immunities of citizens of the United States. Well, of course, that pledge was neglected, forgotten for nearly a century. But in order to give the inhabitants of Alaska, ultimately, the advantages, rights, and immunities of citizens of the United States, predicated three things which he did not have as a territory, namely the right to vote for president and vice president, the right to elect our own state officials under a constitution of our own making, and finally to be represented in the Congress by two senators and at least one representative in the House with a vote, because all the time we were a territory, and only a part of that time, in the last half century, we were represented in the Congress only by a voteless delegate in the House of Representatives who could speak but could not vote even on the Alaska matter. In other words, we were pretty much disfranchised. All this time, of course, Alaska was paying all federal income taxes, all the taxes, so that we were suffering taxation without representation, which, as you all know, our colonial forefathers declared to be tyranny in 1775, and was certainly no less so in the 20th century, 2018. So, the first statehood bill was introduced way back in 1916 by a man who was, I think, the foremost Alaskan in the first third of our century, James Wickersham, delegate at that time in the House. Wickersham had come to Alaska in 1900. He was sent up here as a federal judge by President Theodore Roosevelt to dispose of the so-called cannon jumping cases in Nome. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that famous episode, but it's been immortalized in a novel by Rex Peach called The Spoilers, and also in nonfiction by him and others. What happened up there was that a crooked federal judge and his confederate sought to take away the claims of some of the gold miners and really steal his property. And it was quite a scandal, and ultimately this judge was removed from the bench and one of his confederates sentenced to jail. And Judge Wickersham was sent up here to clean up this mess. And he was a distinguished judge, a member, really almost a father of such legislation as he subsequently had. And in 1908, 2 years after we had been given the right to have a voter's delegate, in all the years from 1867 until 1906, a period of neglect of 39 years, also without precedent or parallel, we did not even have the representation of one voter's delegate. Well, two were elected successively in the first biennium, and then Wickersham came in and was re-elected repeatedly from 1908 until 1920, and then once more in 1930. And in those days, we were suffering after a period of almost no government for 35 years, an organic act, the Organic Act of 1912, which was really the first workable organic act, but it was highly restrictive. And it denied Alaska many things which other territories have had, such as the right to control our natural resources, our fisheries and wildlife, the right to make land laws, the right to have our own judiciary. And Wickersham, who had been responsible for getting this to Congress, which was an achievement, but with which he was not satisfied because of its restrictive provisions, felt that we would never get anywhere until we had statehood. At that time, the cry was for full territorialism. In other words, a territorial charter that would be minus these particular restrictions. Well, he felt, after studying the matter and trying to oppose all the predatory interests that were trying to hold Alaska back and exploit our natural resources and leaving nothing here, that the only solution would be statehood, and he introduced the first statehood bill on March 30th, 1916, Seward Day, the 39th anniversary of his purchase. Well, of course, that bill never got out of committee, and I think you know from your studies of the way government functions that the first step in securing any piece of legislation is to refer it to the appropriate committee of the Senate or the House, and there the hearings are held on the bill, if they're held at all, and if that bill does not emerge from the committee with a favorable report, its chances of being enacted are negligible. No bill is ever, or practically never, thrust into the full body of the Senate or House. It goes to the committee first, and probably to a subcommittee. Well, this statehood bill, of course, never even emerged from the subcommittee. I doubt whether any hearings held on it. And then things went along until the 1940s, when it became increasingly evident, it was evident to me as governor at that time and to others, that you never would amount to anything, you never would get anywhere until we had statehood, which was nothing more and nothing less than applying to Alaska the most fundamental of American principles, the principle of government by consent of the governed. We did not have it during all those years of territorialism. The governor was an appointee sent from afar. We were limited in many things we could do. We couldn't even bond ourselves for our needs. There were many restrictions. And in the early 40s, our delegate in Congress introduced a statehood bill. There were two or three at that time. They likewise did not get out of committee. And in 1945, it seemed to be desirable that we move more rapidly in the situation, and that before we could justify going all out for statehood, we would have to get an opinion, a view of the people of Alaska as to where they really wanted statehood. Without that mandate from the people, those of us who believed in it had no authority to proceed. And during those years, and in the time of the Organic Act of 1912, until the 40s, there was very little going on here. Alaska was stagnant. We were getting very little aid from the federal government. We were getting no legislation that would enable us to develop. And so in the 1945 legislature, a bill was introduced to provide a referendum at the next election, which would take place in October 1946, to determine whether or not the people of Alaska wanted statehood. And shortly after this legislature, which met from January to March of 1945, adjourned, President Roosevelt died, was succeeded by President Truman, and one of his first pronouncements was to invite the governor to come and visit him and to discuss their problems. And I took advantage of that to visit him when he was on the West Coast visiting his friend, Governor of Washington, Mon Walgren, and I went down there to see whether I could not secure his support for statehood. And I told him that what had happened was that the legislature had provided for a referendum at the coming election, and I asked whether he could see it very clear in his first State of the Union message, which always is the first president step after he takes office, and would take place the following January, just as soon as the next Congress convened, whether he could see his way clear to endorse statehood and ask the Congress to enact the appropriate legislation. And he said he would, and he did. And in his first State of the Union message in January of 1946, he asked that the Congress pass legislation giving statehood to Hawaii, which was also seeking statehood, and had been at it much longer than we, and was far more qualified than Alaska because it had the rest of its population and a stable and growing economy, which Alaska did not have. And he went on to say that if the people of Alaska indicated at their coming October election that they wanted statehood, that he hoped that the Congress would likewise endorse enact legislation to give that to Alaska as well as to Hawaii. Well, the people of Alaska did vote for statehood by a proportion of about 3-2. It was not an overwhelming proportion. The vote was small. It was about 9,000 and some odd to 6,000 and some odd. And the one reason that it was small is there was a great deal of feeling among many people, and correctly so, that until we had a revenue system, until we had an income that would enable us to support the additional requirements of statehood, we weren't ready for it. And an adequate revenue system had been something that the absentee interest, which controlled our state during those years, had steadily fought against. And they continued to fight against it until the 1948 election, when they had so badly mishandled the 1947 legislature, leaving the territory virtually bankrupt, leaving it going out with $4 million worth more of projects than they made appropriations for, that there was a revolt on the party electorate. Practically all that, those legislators were thrown out. And in 1949, we began to lay the foundation for statehood by passing a comprehensive revenue legislation, all of which has stood up until this day. We passed for the first time an income tax, which we hadn't had. And it was done on a new basis, a rather intelligent basis. You know, one difficulty that people have in paying income taxes is the headache in making it out, besides the headache when you have to pay it. And in most states where they have income taxes, they have an entirely different formula for the state income tax that they have for the federal income tax, with the result that those who make out their income taxes have to go through this headache twice, always feeling the risk, on the one hand, not recording enough and therefore going to jail, or recording too much and therefore cheating themselves. Well, the formula adopted by the 1949 legislature, a very sensible one, was to gear the state income tax to the federal, and so it is today. And in other words, the state merely has a legislation by which you pay a percentage, 10%, 12%, I think it's 16% now, of what you pay the federal government. And the advantage of that is that the state authorities have to do very little checking. They have access to the federal income tax. They have to do very little in the way of collecting, because they know automatically whether the returns have been properly made. And then in addition to that, they passed a property tax, which was later repealed, a business license tax. And perhaps the most enlightened of all the taxes was a progressive sales tax, which has been adopted by every city in the state except Anchorage, which provides that if any community wants a particular project, let's say a water and sewer system or street paving, they put this on the ballot and ask the people where they want it. And if they want it, the sales tax goes into effect at whatever rate has been decided is necessary, 1 cent, 1%, or 2%, or 3%. And that tax stays on until the project is paid for, and then automatically goes off. And if the people don't want the project, they simply vote against it, and they don't get the project, and don't pay the taxes. And then there was a progressive trap tax, which was designed to diminish the evils of the fish trap, which is a highly controversial issue among our fishermen and others, by which the large structures took tremendous quantities of fish, and in the view of fishermen, depleted our fishery resources. Well, having voted for statehood, it gave those of us who believed in it and thought it necessary a mandate to go out and work for it, which we proceeded to do. And in my own case, being governor, I was obligated to go to Washington 4 or 5 times a year to testify before committees on Alaska's needs to assist our voter delegate in his efforts. And on these occasions, I would seek every opportunity to address groups who wanted to hear about Alaska. And Alaska has always been a matter of great interest. There's been a great glamour about Alaska among people in the United States. And I would tell them about the scenic beauties of Alaska and the friendliness of its people and our unspoiled wilderness and our abundance of wildlife. But then I would also talk about our problems and how necessary it was, in my view, to get rid of our territorial status and have self-government, and urge them to support statehood. And there would be an invariable question period in which someone would ask, what can we do to help you get stated? And my reply, of course, would be that stated would come when in a given Congress, a majority of the members of the Senate and the House voted for a stated bill. And of course, it has to be in the same Congress, because it happened subsequently. One House would pass a stated bill, the other would not, and then we would have to begin all over again. And then I would say that there were those present, and I would address women's clubs and teachers' conventions and fraternal organizations and service clubs and so on. If there were those who were sympathetic with our cause and wanted to help us, they could do so by writing just three letters, one to each of their two senators and one to their representative. And then I made an interesting, rather depressing discovery. And that is the vast amount of what I might call political illiteracy existed in our country. Because repeatedly, after I had finished giving this very simple formula of how they could help state it by writing these two letters to their two senators and their representatives, I was asked, by the way, who is your representative? And it would be amazing to see in how many groups there wouldn't be a single person who could even give the answer. That's the name of their representative. Well, if you don't know the name of your representative, you're still further removed from knowing how he acts, whether he represents the views that you think he should, whether he is alert and active and so forth. And I doubt whether that would happen here, but it happened in so many cases that it was rather striking. I remember the most conspicuous example of it. I was addressing the women's club of a very fashionable suburb of Pittsburgh, which holds the same relationship to Pittsburgh as Westchester County does to New York. And this was a magnificent building owned by the Women's Club, and I faced an audience of 300 beautifully begowned, bejeweled, and deferred ladies, and the limousines were stretched for half a mile down the road, with chauffeurs waiting to take them back. And when I said, by the way, who is your congressman? Not a single one of these ladies, who were the queen of the queen of Pittsburgh, could answer. It struck me very shocking. And this is something which, this is digression, but I think if we're going to be good citizens, we have to be more aware and more alert as to what our government is like. And if I were a president or regent of the university, I would insist on two requirements before I would let any student graduate. And that is, he'd be able to write and read the English language intelligibly and correctly. And he would have some knowledge of the function of government. There's a very interesting illustration of that lack of knowledge here. Some 1 or 2 years ago, there was a senator here from Wasilla in the state legislature by the name of Heinz Snyder. And one Alaskan young woman went down to Washington, and the station was then Senator Barton's office, and he suggested that she might like to go and listen to what was going on in the Senate. So one of the staff took this lady over to the Senate and seated in the gallery, and she saw her looking around now at the senator coming in, and she said, "Where's Heinz Snyder?" And she said, "Well, I suppose he's back at Wasilla." And she said, "Why isn't he here?" So she said, "Well, why should he be here?" Well, she said, "Well, isn't he a senator?" Now, apparently, she didn't know the difference between the state senate and the national senate, which, after all, would seem to be fairly elementary. And I'm quite confident that some of you take political science courses would not be mistaken about. Well, in any event, we had these successive hearings on stated. It began in 1947 in the House and then in the Senate, and the report would be invariably favorable, and committees would come up here and hold hearings. But somehow we were never able to get action in both the Senate and the House at the same time. One year the Senate would pass the bill, but the House would not, and then the next year the reverse would take place. And so finally, in 1955, the legislature, becoming impatient, took a very bold step and appropriated $300,000 and authorized a Constitution Convention, which it was hoped to draw up the Constitution for the state that the people of the legislature and the Alaskans wanted to bring into being. And the Constitution Convention met here on the campus of the University of Alaska in the early winter of 1955. It was composed of 55 delegates, which was the same historic number as those who met in Philadelphia in 1787 and drafted the Constitution of the United States. And after meeting here for 75 days, they drafted the Constitution, which political scientists declared to be as good as, if not better than, any existing state charter. And this Constitution was placed on the ballot for the following April to have the people of Alaska determine whether they wanted or not. But there was an additional wrinkle which was of great historic importance, and that was this. A few years earlier, a public-spirited citizen of Louisiana was stationed in the Navy during World War II in Hawaii, and he became very much interested in the cause of Hawaiian statehood. And he had dug up an extremely interesting precedent in American history that very few people knew about. And that precedent was that in 1796, the people situated in the area west of North Carolina and south of Kentucky, which had been admitted as statehood as the 14th state, as the 15th state in 1792, and unhappy because the first three Congresses had not admitted them to statehood, and envious because Kentucky had gotten them, decided to jump the gun, to use a fact phrase, and elected two senators, which was easier to do then than subsequently, because in those days, senators were elected by the legislature, not by the people. And they elected two senators and sent them to the national capital, which was then Philadelphia, to work for statehood and to persuade the members of the Congress that they should have statehood. And they came back with it. And in 1796, Tennessee became the 15th state. And this same procedure was then followed by seven other states, Michigan in 35, and Iowa in 46, California in 50, and Minnesota in 58, and Oregon in 59, and Kansas in 61. But this precedent had been forgotten. And this man, George Lehlachner, suggested this to the delegate of Hawaii, whose name was Joe Farrington, who was the editor and publisher of the leading paper there, and to the previous delegate, who was then in the Navy, had been an Annapolis graduate, and they rejected the idea on the ground that it wasn't necessary. They fully expected that the next Congress would give Hawaii statehood. They were counting on the speaker to do it for them. But it didn't happen. And so George Lehlachner, who at that time had no interest in Alaska, thought that maybe the Alaskans would take this bold step, and he came and talked to me about it, and I thought it was an excellent idea, and I suggested that he go up and address the Constitution Convention, which was then in session, and see if he could not sell this idea to them, persuade them to do it. And I talked to some of the members of the convention, pointed out that my Hawaii had 6 years earlier passed the Constitution and were ready to go, but that Constitution was simply gathering dust and pigeonholes and was getting nowhere, and that the same thing might happen to us unless we took some additional bold steps, such as adopting the Alaska Tennessee Plan, as we called it then. And this was placed on the ballot along with the Constitution, and the people ratified it. And then there was an election, and three of us, Bill Egan, who at that time had been president of the Constitution Convention, and Ralph Rivers, who has been the representative in Congress until very recently, and I were elected. And we went to Washington, members of the so-called Alaska Tennessee Plan delegation, to try to persuade the Congress to give us statehood. Now, we were not treated. We were not treated as the delegates in Tennessee had been, or the delegates in California. On the contrary, we had no status except those that of lobbyists. And we were told immediately that if we wanted the approval of the Republicans, we would all have to either run again, we were all three Democrats, which we readily assented to, because after all, we were there to get statehood. and whether we were re-elected is not important. So we worked on this for 2 years, and in the course of time, we were able to persuade a sufficient number of the members of the Congress to give us favor. We had considerable obstacles to overcome. The two most serious obstacles were contained in the $64 word non-contiguity, which was very startling to a number of members of Congress to vote in as a state an area which was not touching the other 48 states. Up to that time, it had been a rectangular block, the other 48 states, and there was a good deal of objection there. And many arguments were raised that if we went overseas and admitted Alaska and then Hawaii, why we would be admitting New Zealand and Australia, and there were all kinds of fanciful conjectures. Well, we were able to overcome that. And the next argument was that we had so little, such a small population, which was a great obstacle. And people who were very sympathetic with our cause in general would say, how can you justify admitting this handful of people? And the census of 1950 only gave us 125,000 people. Although by 1958, when we were working as members of Alaska Tennessee Plan, we calculated that our population had risen to pretty close to 200,000, at least that's what we claimed. And that how could you justify giving two senators to so few people when the great state of New York with 15 million people had two? Well, that was an argument that weighed with a good many of these people who continued to oppose statehood. And the answer is by pointing out that if this argument has prevailed from the very beginning, we would still have only the original 13 states, because the states, the newer states, west of the Appalachians, always had very few people, very many fewer people than the 13 original states, and that they got population only because, and when they got stated and people began to move in, and the westward migration began. So we finally overcame that, and we got stated. Now it is true, I think the monster is extremely beneficial to Alaska, but it's also beneficial to the nation. And this is one of the questions that we frequently ask. We'd be asked to justify statehood by saying, what will it do for the United States? Well, this question had not been raised in previous debates on statehood, all of which I have been eager to read to see all the various arguments that were used. And we found very interestingly that many states had great difficulty in getting in. Arizona and New Mexico, for instance, which were the last states admitted before Alaska in 1912, and had waited for 50 years to get stated, they might have gone in. New Mexico Territory, as it was called for many years, could have gone in at about the same time that California went in 1850. But they did not do what California did and what Alaska did, namely elect two senators and send them to Washington to fight for stated. And in these debates, there would be a lot of severe criticism. They would say, what is it down there to justify making a state? Nothing but deserts and cactus and lizards and Gila monsters and Indians and so forth. Well, they didn't say that about Alaska, but they always said this is a land of snow and ice. The old myth about the uninhabitability of Alaska, which arose at the time of its purchase, when it was called, as you know, many harsh names, Seward's Polar Bear Garden and Iceberg and Walrus, and Seward's Folly, which is the epithet the longest. But we did manage to overcome that. But we were also asked, what would be the benefits to the United States? Well, we indicated in the first place, if we wanted to be true to our professions, we couldn't have any colonies, and that's in effect what Alaska and Hawaii were. They were territories held in an inferior status, without full government by consent of their people, and that if we wanted to demonstrate that America was true to its profession, we would include them and give the remaining areas, which perhaps did not qualify for status for lack of population and economy, as much self-government as possible. And that had some effect. And actually, it's so true, because in the 50s, in the middle of the 50s, a certain amount of an inferiority complex developed among Americans. This was a time when Russia had put up its first satellite in orbit, the Sputnik. And this was considered a great blow to our prestige, and many people wondered whether we were not declining And many people prophesied that we were on the way out, like ancient Rome, that we were deteriorating. But the admission of Alaska and Hawaii, which extended the frontiers of democracy and freedom to our furthest north and our farthest west in the case of Alaska, and our farthest south in the case of Hawaii, and actually promoted this with a naked eye view of the Soviet police state across Bering Strait, demonstrated that Alaska was still young, that the United States was still young, still vigorous, still on the march, and was still in process of growth. And I think it had a very beneficial effect throughout the nation. Actually, the people of the United States favored status for Alaska long before the Congress did. The people were ahead of the Congress in their thinking. The Gallup polls increasingly showed a tremendous growing enthusiasm for status for Alaska and Hawaii. And when we were fighting for status for Alaska, we were also fighting for status for Hawaii. And the fact of the matter was that both were desirable, Hawaii particularly, because Hawaii was the finest example of ethnic democracy under the American flag, with a total absence of race prejudice there, which is one of the reasons why it has been long opposed by some of our representatives from the southern states. And when we were out in Hawaii, we find certain people who, when we asked them whether they didn't want statehood, would lower their voices and say, no, we don't want it. And then when we inquired curiously why they didn't want it, they would lower their voice and say, how would you like to have a family called Moto? Well, the interesting fact was that we have four representatives in Congress, two in the Senate and two in the House, all of Oriental origin, one of Chinese descent, one of Japanese descent. And we have a senator whose name is Inoue. And when he was asked to take the oath of office and hold up his right hand and take the oath, he was unable to do it because he'd lost his right arm fighting to rescue a Texas battalion in Italy in World War II. It was one of the most dramatic and moving episodes. So that idea, of course, has gone completely out of the window. And when we extended this to Hawaii and to Alaska, we demonstrated not only the youth and vigor of our country, but we said once and for all, that the objections which had held Hawaii out from becoming a state were no longer valid. Now, it is an interesting fact, although we have statehood, we have a lot of catching up to do, and the discrimination of 92 years are still far from being liquidated. One of the most striking evidence of that is our lack of highways. And this is pertinent to the fact that the heritage of our 92 years of colonialism is still with us. These are now temporary, burning, pressing problems that we have to face. And I think I want to say a word about that, merely to illustrate this as an example of rather similar heritage that we have to liquidate, and it's part of our problem. In 1916, Congress passed one of the most important pieces of legislation that it's ever passed, and that was known as the Federal Aid Highway Act. And this was enacted just about the time when the automobile had become a reasonably usable instrument of locomotion. It had been invented by Henry Ford in the 90s, and for a couple of decades thereafter, was more or less in the joke stage. It was not a perfected instrument. And when people in those days would go out to spin over a dusty road and would break down, there was no such thing as raising the hood. You had to lie down in the dust and work from below up. And it was in the joke stage. People called it the horse's carriage. So actually, a lot of people couldn't quite believe that something on wheels could move unless there was a horse to pull it. But by 1916, it had become reasonably perfected, and the Congress realized that if this new vehicle were to be made widely useful, we would have to have a uniform system of highways of a fairly high standard, and that could be done only by joint federal and state cooperation. Because if it were left wholly to the states as it had been, you would have a wide disparity between the roads in one state and another. In a road-minded state, a progressive state, or perhaps a wealthy state, you would have fine paved highways. And when you crossed from that state into another, where there was a different attitude, what had been a fine paved highway would suddenly deteriorate into a dust heap in dry weather and a mud puddle in wet. In order to obviate that, the Congress proposed federal matching, $1 federal funds for $1 state funds, with the understanding that the states would build up to a high standard, a uniform standard throughout the nation set by the federal government. But the western states, then 11 in number, where there were large areas of public domain, public lands owned by the federal government, which were not subject to taxation by the state and therefore produced no revenue, got a more generous formula than the 50-50 matching of the eastern and middle western states. And that was a complicated formula based on four factors: the total area of the state, the proportion of public domain to total area, the population, and the existing road mileage. Well, when the congressman acting on this legislation in 1916 contemplated the size of Alaska and the proportion of public domain to the total, which was 100%, because at that time all the land was owned by the federal government, they shuddered and refused to include Alaska. And for the next 40 years, from 1916 until 1956, our voters delegates would hopefully introduce legislation in every session of Congress asking that we be included in this. These bills never got out of committee. And that is the reason why Alaska finally entered the Union in the unique situation, unthinkable in the lower 48 states, by which not merely a few, but a majority of our communities are unconnected by any with any other by highway or railway. Now here, in the central part of the state, we have the only highway system that exists, the highway which connects with the United States and the Glen Highway, which goes around Anchorage. But westward, the whole map is blank. And this is one of the things we have to catch up about. Now, in 1956, a further discrimination loomed up against Alaska. Mind you, all this time we were paying all federal taxes, and a further discrimination took place when President Eisenhower proposed a vast enlargement and improvement of our highway system, partly to take care of the great number of increased cars, the greater traffic, and also to act as a state route in case of atomic attack, which was here at that time. And President Eisenhower proposed no immediate outlay, but long-term bonding. The Congress agreed with the desirability of the program, but disagreed with the President's commitment to the finances. Congress thought it would not be proper to burden posterity with the benefits that this generation would receive, and proposed instead a pay-as-you-go system with additional taxes on trucks, trailers, tires, and gas. And unfortunately, the President and Congress agreed on one thing, and that was that Alaska should be denied the benefits of this legislation, but included in the taxation. This was typical of the discrimination that she suffered. So for the next 3 years until we got statehood, whenever any of you went to a gas station and said, fill her up, you were paying 1 cent a gallon additional to build roads in the 48 states, but not in Alaska. And that was true of the additional cost of your trucks and trailers and tires. My period is up and ready for the question period, but this is one of the many things that confronts us today, and we have to do a lot of catching up. And this applies not merely to highways, it applies to other things. But this is a great challenge, and one that we're happy to meet. Now, we have, I think, about 12 minutes for questions. I wish I could tell you more along the same line, but I think I've given you the basis to bring you up to date and perhaps confront you with some of the things that we need to do and ought to do as a state of the Union. Thank you very much. Yes. Well, of course, I am completely a dissenter from a whole military engagement in Vietnam. I think it is completely illegal, immoral, unconstitutional. And in order to answer your question, I have to give you that preliminary, because of course I'm in favor of the bombing force, but I'm in favor of much more than that. I'm in favor of not having been there in the first place. And briefly, I would say that while this is not the prevailing opinion in my country, and of course is not the official opinion, I would say to you that I've opposed it consistently for 3 years, and should continue to do so, that the reasons alleged for our being there, that we were invited in by a friendly government to help with the telegraphy, are false. There is no truth in them. And that even if it had been true, there was very much of a question whether we should send our young men to fight and die because the country asked us to. If such an arrangement was contemplated, it shouldn't be done by executive action. It should be preceded by a lengthy debate in the Senate, and then the enactment of a treaty with that nation, which would spell out specifically what the extent of our aid and our commitment would be. That never took place. So we've gradually gotten in there now, and actually, when we went in there first, we were the only outsiders, the only intruders, the only people there were Vietnamese, North and South. We precipitated a civil war. I have to shorten this because of time, but all these things can be documented. And when we started bombing North and South and sent troops into combat, it is we, the United States, who became the aggressor. It is not true that we are fighting aggression. There was infiltration and has been infiltration from the north of North Vietnamese helping their South Vietnamese brothers to engage in the civil war, but only after we had violated every treaty to which we had which we were signatories and had broken those treaties and ceased our arms and our manpower commitment and were really the aggressors. Now, if we had stayed out of it completely, as we could have, I'm convinced that we now have three independent countries and the situation is infinitely better. The year before last, in 1965, there were 96,000 desertions from the South Vietnamese Army. These are our official figures. I think they're slightly understated. Last year, 110,000 desertions. And yet we're drafting our young men to go and fight people against whom they have no reason and to die in the process, and the South Vietnamese, and they're presumably aiding, have so little interest in their own cause. So I'm in favor of anything that will stop the killing, and the bombing is wholly illegal, it's wholly immoral, and unjustified. And I agree with Kennedy, but I think that he should have gone much further. There are only two of us who have consistently opposed this from the very beginning. In 1964, after a presumed attack by three T-boats of North Vietnamese origin on the mighty 7th Fleet, the President ordered a retaliatory raid, and the next day, a resolution drafted in the White House was sent to the Congress to request for speedy enactment, which said that everything that we had done down there was to be approved, and that further than that, the person would have the right to use the armed forces of the United States anywhere that he saw fit in Southeast Asia. It passed the House unanimously, and in the Senate there were two of us who voted against it, Senator Wayne Morse of Oregon and I. And out of that resolution stems a tremendous escalation, whereby from only advisors down there, we now have 415,000 men under arms in Vietnam, 70,000 in the fleet, 40,000 in neighboring Thailand, and a steady escalation going on. And we're at war now, an undeclared war, which itself is in violation of the Constitution, and in my judgment, it's totally unjustified. We are not attacked, nothing that we valued was jeopardized, and no good can come of it. And I amplify your question because I can't answer why I approve the bombing force unless I tell you that I disapprove the whole business. Well, I haven't seen the what is true, but I think that if he was not penalized, it was a great mistake. We have been subject to poaching by foreign vessels, Japanese and Russians, and at the last session of Congress, we extended the 50 limits from the traditional 3 miles, which are obsolete, dates from the days when a cannonball, a century ago or more, was supposed to travel only 3 miles, and extended to 12 miles. And the law provided penalties for those caught poaching. And if the captain was released, I think it's a great mistake and a great disservice to our fishermen. I think you ought to make it clear that poaching will be punished. This will just lead to further disrespect to the law. And I see no reason why foreign violators of the law should be immune or exempt from the kind of punishment we would mete out to our own people if they violated the law. Yes. I can't hear you. Can you talk a louder? Would somebody who was old social came to that question was? Well, I'm in favor of development. Well, my view of future economic development is hopeful. We have a number of very favorable factors. The fisheries, after being virtually ruined under federal mismanagement, are now coming back. We are beginning to develop trade with Japan, which is a very promising development, and almost a unique development, under which a single state has developed a trade of its own with a foreign country. The Japanese furnish a market for many of our materials, which there is no market in the 48 lower states. And I think this is very promising. Then in addition to that, Alaska is becoming the air crossways of the Northern Hemisphere, with people traveling back and forth between Europe, North America, and Asia. And I think this will be a great help to our tourist industry, which I think is in great potential. And we have very many undeveloped resources here, which can be usefully and profitably developed. And I think that the future of Alaska, the economic development of Alaska is very promising. Our mining needs some assistance, which is our mining policy has been rather unwise, but I think we are in a position to now modify that. Yes. We are not stopping the spread of communism by what we are doing. The Chinese couldn't enjoy the situation more. They haven't committed a single soldier into this war. And yet there we are, bleeding to death. We have lost over 9,000 fine young Americans in combat, some 3,000 more not in combat. Some 50,000 have been wounded, some of them crippled for life, blinded, armless, legless, and we are pouring our substance at the rate of $2.5 billion a month down there, while all our domestic programs are going down the drain. The Chinese love this situation. We are playing their game. And if we had stayed out of it, they would not be in Vietnam, they would not be in Southeast Asia, because those countries want their own independence. The Vietnamese drove out the Chinese 1,000 years ago and to test them. They drove out the Japanese, they drove out the French, and they would like to drive us out. And stopping communism by weakening our own economy and our own development, we're aiding communism. This is not the way to stop communism. The way to stop communism is to demonstrate that the Western way of life, the free system, with its freedom of speech and press and assembly and concern for the people, is a better system and more productive of human happiness. But unfortunately, the men that we have installed in office or allowed to remain in office have no such feeling about their own people. They're a bunch of grafters, they're getting rich, and they have no popular support. And the simplest way for us to fight communism is to demonstrate that our system is a better system, and to resist aggression when it really concerns us, as it does not in Asia. Yes. No, I do not think so. On the contrary, the bombing has not stopped the infiltration from increasing. Ever since we started bombing, our casualties have been rising. It's merely hardened the resistance of the enemy. Every time our military geniuses advise some new step, we get in deeper and deeper, and our casualties mount more and more.
I would like to ask further questions.
Thank you. If you think it advisable, it's afternoon, and we could have a longer question period. I suspect there are a lot of questions some would like to ask. So it's entirely up to you or the professor to determine how you'd like the program run. I'm willing to do whatever you want.